nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so today I'd like to try to summarize what we have been doing so far, and that's like 7 weeks now, so about half the course really, a little less than half. And I handed out like a set of notes. I mean, these are things that you have handed out parts of it before, but it's now all collected together. And for the midterm exam, this is something you'll have. So it will be handed out with the exam, so you'll have that for your reference anyway. Okay, and also handed out a set of problems that's just to help you prepare. You don't need to submit these. Early next week, we'll post the solutions. You can go through them, see. Right. So it's not meant for, not like you need to do it and submit it. Okay. And okay. So to get started then, this course, the basic idea is to how to think about and model current flow on an atomic scale, on a very small scale. And as you know, this is a problem of particular interest these days because people are making very useful electronic devices where the length of the active region, the length of the actual conductor that determines the current flow, is down to hundreds of atoms. I mean, in the laboratory, it can even be one or two atoms. And commercial devices, like what you have in your computer, that's like 500 atoms long, the channel length. And so the question is, how do you think about current flow on that scale? And here, let me just write down a couple of length scales. So a millimeter is like what we all understand. That's about that much. And then there's a micrometer, that's about 1,000th. And then a nanometer would be another 1,000th. And atomic distances are typically like a fifth of a nanometer or so. So a nanometer contains like 3 to 5 atoms. Okay. Now, usually our understanding of current flow has gone like this top down, in the sense that 20, 30 years ago, the only measurements where we really knew the answers experimentally were conductors that were this long. And so our usual thinking also has progressed in the same way. And so the starting point usually is that the conductance is equal to sigma A over L. That's what you would learn somewhere in your freshman classes, that conductance depends on area, inversely as length, that's conductivity. And usually the conductivity you relate to, there's this simple theory that you see somewhere that says it's proportional to the electron density. And the way you think about it is that, you know, current is Q times the electron density times the velocity, V. And V, you say, is like mobility times electric field. And mobility is Q tau over M. So that's the usual argument you go through. And this is then the expression for conductivity that you often use. Okay. Now, the first part, few classes, then, what I was trying to explain is that, you see, when you go down to small dimensions, there's two kinds of things you run into. One, that actually has to do with the wave nature of electrons. But that's relatively uncommon in terms of what you observe experimentally, especially at room temperature. Most of the time, wave nature doesn't quite directly manifest itself. And the reason I mentioned later in the course that is because of phase-breaking processes. Because what's special about wave is interference. And interference requires this very delicate thing involving phase. And at room temperature especially, what you really have is a fairly turbulent medium. And phase information is usually washed out. I mean, under special conditions, you can see it. In very small devices, it can be important. But by and large, lots of things that you run into in small devices do not have much to do with the wave nature of electrons. And so a good place to start, like in this course, the first few weeks we talked about what's called the semi-classical theory. Semi-classical theory, as I said, is you can understand almost like cars going on a highway. I mean, there is nothing quantum mechanical about it almost. The reason you call it semi-classical rather than fully classical is because you do get some information from quantum mechanics, which is the density of states, which is like how many lanes do you have on your highway. That part, at a given energy, around the chemical potential, how many lanes do you have, how fast do the lanes go, etc. That information you are getting from quantum mechanics. Like you're saying that, well, let's say for this material we have some EK diagram, something that we know. So usually in the undergraduate course, I don't assume that you have heard of EK diagrams. We kind of start from atoms and talk at length about EK diagrams. In this class, I'm assuming that you have heard of it. So I'm not although not necessarily in great depth, but at least you know that in solids, most of the time, you can describe electrons in terms of E versus K. That looks like a parabola, and the parabola can be approximated with some effective mass. Of course, EK diagrams can be more complicated, and there can be other details that come in, but you could, but so far, whatever we have talked about involves just what you call a simple parabolic band of some kind. And I'm assuming you have heard of that, and you know that the velocity at any energy, that's this dE dK, velocity associated with electrons. And you have states, plus k states that are going one way, minus k states that are going the other way. So that's really all the input from quantum mechanics, in a way, in that semi-classical theory. After that, it's really just like cars on a highway. No more quantum mechanics in that, really. And just that is enough to understand a lot of the things that you see in small devices. Understand. And one of the most important things that I was stressing is that this conductance, instead of going down with length like so, actually goes down something like this. So that when the length gets really small, it doesn't, conductance doesn't, resistance doesn't become zero, or conductance doesn't become infinite. It actually tends to a constant value. And this, as I said, wasn't at all clear in the 80s. And in the early 80s, there are lots of papers just arguing about just this. What would happen if you had made a resistor very short? So, but this is something you could understand with the semi-classical theory. You don't really need a full quantum mechanical description. Okay. Now, the other point I tried to stress is that this conductivity with this expression is kind of misleading, because it gives the impression that how well something conducts depends on how many electrons you have. And that's really not right, because even the best insulators, are insulating not because they don't have any electrons, really. They have lots of electrons, as many as any other solid, really. Right? The reason they don't conduct is simply that these electrons do not have an energy around the chemical potential. Because the essence of current flow is that you've got these two contacts with two different chemical potentials, and this one keeps trying to fill up these levels, and this one keeps trying to empty them. And these are the states that matter. If you don't have states around here, it cannot conduct. So having a whole bunch of states down here doesn't help as far as conduction goes. It contributes to many other properties of a solid, many other very important properties like its mechanical properties and so on, but not to current flow. See? And that kind of is hidden or kind of lost in this picture. And a better expression, which is what we try to go through in this class, is the one where sigma is this dE minus del F del E times the density of states per unit volume. Or if it's a two-dimensional conductor, you'd use width times length. And then times V square tau, I guess, over D is the number of dimensions. That basically it is like the average of VZ squared if you are talking of current flow in the Z direction. And if you have three dimensions, then the average value of VZ squared is like 1/3 of the average value of V squared. Because V squared is like VX squared plus VY squared plus Z squared. So, yeah, You could write it this way. So this is the expression that I'd say is much more general, applies more generally to any arbitrary density of states. And if you apply it to a case where the density of states is determined by one parabolic band, then you can show that this will give you back this q squared n tau over m that we had. But more generally, it's really this. And the important thing about this formula that's nice is that it has this del f del e. And that has to do with the basic idea that current flow is because the Fermi function here looks like this, and the Fermi function here looks like this. And at any energy, the driving term is really the difference between F1 and F2, which for small bias can be written as del F del E. Can be written as minus del F del E. Let me write that up there. For small bias, you could write F as some standard value at equilibrium plus minus del F del E times mu 1 minus mu 2 times mu, whatever the mu at that point. So for low bias, we argued that the Fermi function could be written as a sort of a Taylor series expansion out of the equilibrium value. And this then you could call the local electrochemical potential. So at every point, the electrons will be distributed according to some function f, which in general, of course, does not need to be a Fermi function because that's only true at the contacts. But for low bias, it's roughly a Fermi function, different places, and you could define a mu like this. Though, as we discussed again, that for low bias, the positive going states might have a different mu from the negative going states, like a quasi-Fermi level, just as in electronic devices, sometimes electrons and holes have different quasi-Fermi levels. Here it's like positive going states and negative going states could have different quasi-Fermi levels. Now, the point is that the driving term then is this difference in Fs, and that's reflected by this. So the only way you get conductivity is when you have a density of states at the same energy where del F del E is non-zero. And del F del E is non-zero only right around here. It's zero way down here, it's zero way up there, it's non-zero only around here. And it's only around here that you need density of states to conduct. That's important thinking. Now, this comes out of this expression in terms of L plus lambda, etc., usually is derived from something called the Boltzmann equation. So that's usually the fundamental basis for all this semi-classical theory that people always start from. It's called the Boltzmann equation. Whereas what you normally use at longer length scales is diffusion equation or drift diffusion. And as you go to small devices, the point is this one isn't quite adequate because if you use this without any special tricks, you'll get a conductance of sigma A over L, not L plus lambda. On the other hand, if you had started from this, whereas this one, however, is usually fairly difficult. It takes quite a few lectures just to understand what the equation is and actually apply it, and that's something we didn't go into. There's a course in AA, I think it's 656, which is really all about the Boltzmann equation. So this we didn't really go into. On the other hand, the basic results that we discussed, and I kind of simplified this by saying, let us stick to what's called elastic transport. Namely, electrons go from one energy, and when they come out here, they're at exactly the same energy. So no energy is exchanged in between. It can turn around and all that, but energy-wise, it stays the same. And then all the dissipation happens at the two ends. Now, if you assume that, then you see it's conceptually and overall, it gets a whole lot clearer because it means you can think of current flow one energy at a time. You don't really have to put them all together. So finally, it's sort of like, okay, let's figure out what's the current at a given energy. And then if you really need the total current, just integrate over energy. Just sum it all up. They're all independent things, parallel stuff. You know, if you're doing it numerically, it's like every energy could go to a different computer. And you could then add it up in that sense. See? So, so when you have this elastic transport, conceptually, every energy separates out. And then why we went through and discussed how the chemical potential should look like across a conductor and so on. And that's very useful in terms of understanding where exactly this resistance is. What I mean by that is, you see, what we are used to thinking is that if I have a section like this and another section like this, and this is of length L and this is of length L, then the overall, so let's say I call the resistance of this section R1 and call the resistance of that R2. The point is, we expect that R2 should be equal to 2R1. That's what you have been kind of always taught from Ohm's law. But that's not what you'd get if you believe in this. Because you see, if you drop the lambda, then you get that. Because then resistance is proportional to length, twice the length, gives you twice the resistance. But once you include that, it's not quite working that way. And so one needs to understand that when I put these two things together, why exactly, although I'm putting them in series, how come it's not exactly adding up, really? And this is the subtle issue that we try to discuss in terms of the fact that what we call resistance has two parts to it. One is the associated with the interfaces, and another that's actually associated with the conductor itself. And when you put two things together, you can just add resistances if there is another contact here, actually. Another contact so that there's an interface resistance. On the other hand, if you do not have an interface here, then you cannot quite add resistances because these interfaces resistances don't really appear. You only add the, this interface resistance only happens at the two ends. You see, only comes along at the two ends. So these issues, in order to understand that, as we discussed, a good way to do it is, in a structure like this, look at how the electrochemical potential varies. Because the electrochemical potential, in a way, is just like voltage. And when you have a series circuit, the current is the same everywhere. So exactly how the voltage drops kind of tells you where the resistance is. Although I should add a little caveat here, is that usually resistance is also associated with joule heating, I squared R. And the way we are thinking about this here, though, there is absolutely no joule heating inside the device. It's all in the contacts. So although we are saying, okay, here's an interface resistance, here's some other resistance, etc., those resistances are not really directly associated with any I squared R. But they do have a IR. They have a voltage drop. That's about it. Okay? So in that sense, it's a little different from what you might have expected just if you just interpret it literally. Okay. So these were the kinds of issues that we talked about. And then we went on to the full quantum theory. That's this NEGF equations. Now talk about. And I say often that one of the ways to see the difference between these three things in a way is that when you are at drift diffusion level, R2 is equal to 2R1. That's Ohm's law. When you're in this ballistic region, then R2 is actually need not be 2R1. It would, but it will still be greater than R1. So anytime you put two things together, you'll always get more resistance, but just not twice. That's all. Not twice because, again, the interface resistance is only at the ends, etc. You won't really get there twice. But once you bring in quantum effects and wave interference, the thing is two sections could have actually less resistance than one, in principle, because of all these wave interference effects. At the right energies, you could easily have a situation where one scatterer cancels the wave reflection due to the other. Okay? Now, normally you don't see much of it in the real world because, again, because of all these phase-breaking processes. And so while in a way NEGF equation is the most fundamental place to start, but then if you when you apply it, you need to include phase-breaking processes into it also, because if you don't, then you'll get all kinds of interferences that won't really compare with any real experiment. Okay. But NEGF equations, as long as you include phase-breaking and all, should cover all this. So in principle, you could apply it straight from the atomic level way up to the macroscopic level, in principle. In practice, the matrices might get big, so you have to figure out the better ways to handle that. And also, as I mentioned, phase breaking needs to be included. Similarly, Boltzmann equation will cover all the way from ballistic limit to the diffusive limit. But but this one will not cover the ballistic region. This will, again, only cover the diffusive region. So in that sense, this is kind of a subset of that. This is a subset of that. So Boltzmann equation will cover everything that you can understand in terms of particles without bringing in wave properties. And what we use today for Boltzmann, for the Boltzmann equation, though, one thing I mentioned is it is really goes somewhat beyond Boltzmann in the sense that when Boltzmann was doing this, he was thinking about classical particles whose E versus V, E versus momentum, or what later nowadays we write with K, has this simple parabolic relation. So energy is half mv squared. Whereas nowadays, when we are applying it to solids, we are saying that for the solid, based on band structure, we could have all kinds of EK relations. But for arbitrary EK relations, we can still use this, and the dynamics then is described by this dx dt equals grad of E with respect to K, that's the velocity, and dk dt is equal to minus grad of E. This is in real space, that's in K gradient. So this is the this, if you apply to a parabolic band, will give you Newton's law. But when you are not in a parabolic band, this is more general. This is what one should be using. Okay. Now, for the NEGF equations then, what we say then is that when you use the starting point is Schrodinger equation. And the Schrodinger equation in this time-dependent form would look something like this. D psi dt equals h psi. And this h is usually a differential operator. But for our discussions, in general, we use the matrix version of this. That is, I said that in general, for any differential equation, you could write an equivalent matrix equation. And the easiest way to see that is, well, let's take a discrete lattice with points like so. In that case, the psi, which is a function, which has a definite value at different points, when you have a discrete lattice, the psi then becomes a column vector. And the H then becomes a matrix. Okay. And the way to establish the equivalence between the two, that is, for a given differential equation, what should be the corresponding difference equation or matrix equation to use? One way to do it is, what I said is, that assume a uniform medium. And for a uniform medium, try to equate the EK relations of the two. So if the EK, because here the way you find the EK relation in a homogeneous medium is you replace d dt with energy, you know, minus IE over h bar, and any d dx with IK. And that's how it becomes an EK relation. right? And that's a solution in any homogeneous medium. That's a mathematical theorem almost. If you have a differential equation with constant coefficients, then solutions can be written in the form of these exponentials. And once you substitute that in there, you'll get an EK relation. So this is one thing that you should be very clear on. It is given a differential equation, how you get an EK relation, and given an EK relation, how to work backwards and write down a differential equation for that matter.
Yes. What if this device is too small that you don't have EK relations?
Right. Good. Yeah, I'll get to that in a minute. Very good point. So, and the difference equation then, here also, as long as it's uniform, which is usually reflected in the matrix being periodic. That is, you go to any row of the matrix and it looks the same. That basically is the equivalent of having a homogeneous medium, of being the same everywhere. And as long as that is true, the solution to this can also be written in the form of plane waves, exactly the same way. And when you substitute that in here, you'll get an EK relation too, here. Except that here, usually the EK relation would be some kind of a power law. E equals k squared or k cubed, k4, something like that. Whereas here, you end up with sines and cosines because you have exponential ikas like we discussed. And the two are equal only for small k. And the way you establish the equivalence is that for small k, you see, if you have something like sine ka, you can replace it with just ka. Or if you have something like cosine, you could replace it with 1 minus k squared a squared over 2. And the idea is that in a given energy range, you could make these two things essentially equivalent by choosing a small enough a, usually. Okay? So that would be one way of viewing it, that this is an approximation to the real differential equation and using a lattice. But in solids often, though, it's kind of the other way. It's like the lattice is the real thing rather than the differential equation in a way. Because in practice, of course, we are dealing with a solid where you with atoms, which are actually discrete. So once you get down to this 2.5 angstrom level, these are really, there's really discrete points, you see? And so one could view this, the matrix equation, as being in a way more fundamental at that level. Because although, you know, this kind of looks like Schrodinger equation, but Schrodinger equation was meant to deal with electrons in vacuum, not for electrons in solids, really. Okay. Now, the question that he asked that, well, what if you had a really small device, you know, something that, let's say, just involves a hydrogen molecule, you know, two hydrogen atoms, something like that. Now, in that case, you see, you don't really have an EK relation because EK relation involves something relatively long, you know, 100 atoms, perhaps. But the thing is, here it's actually in a way easier. That is, well, if I had two hydrogen atoms and I was trying to write down an appropriate matrix for this, I'd probably write something like epsilon on the diagonal and some T here. And then what T should I use? Well, whatever the known energy levels of the hydrogen molecule are, I'd choose my epsilons and Ts to fit the known experiments there. That would be the, if you are using a semi-empirical approach, where you are getting these by fitting certain experiments to make sure that the model you're using has some connection to reality. Okay? So in a way, it's easier. And so I'd say that, you know, from bottom-up point of view, you'd say, well, yeah, any GF equations start at this level, really. You could apply it to molecules, atoms, anything you want. And it is only in bigger solids that it's a little harder. And but that is where it is the easiest thing to do is to compare EK relations. Like you are talking about, say, electrons in a semiconductor, like gallium arsenide or silicon, where you know that the EK relations, say, look parabolic with some effective mass. Well, then you choose your parameters accordingly in this discussion. Okay. Now, once you have this equation, then the next point I made is that in terms of dealing with real devices, though, the Schrodinger equation as it stands is not quite good enough. Because this describes an isolated system. And that is, you know, lots of problems you are often discuss using quantum mechanics. Like if you took a course in nanomaterials, usually you'd be talking about what kind of, you know, what kind of structure would minimize the total energy or things of that sort. And there you are often dealing with an isolated system. So you can say, well, the Hamiltonian is all we need, really. Whereas what we are discussing is this non-equilibrium problem where electrons continually come in and go out. And that open system then requires us to discuss how to connect to the contacts, the two contacts. And usually, though, in the past, people didn't quite do that. What they would do is they'd start from something like this, calculate a conductivity, and then say that, well, we'll connect contacts at the drift diffusion level. In other words, we'll take this whatever material we have, and then based on Schrodinger equation or quantum mechanics, we'll try to figure out what the conductivity should be and compare with experiment, etc. So that's one part of the story. And then once you have conductivity, use drift diffusion equation. The thing is, once we get to small devices, which are like, you know, hundreds of atoms long, you don't really have this clean division. You cannot say we'll do atomistic theory to get sigma and then do drift diffusion theory to do the rest. It's like all has to be one piece. And that's what this theory that we have been discussing lately allows you to do, which is that any material then is described by a Hamiltonian H, a connection to the contact, sigma 1, sigma 2. And once you have these quantities, this thing that describes your material, this that describes your contacts, then you can go ahead and calculate current, voltage, electron density, anything you need, really. Now, and these are the set of equations that we have been developing, that is starting from the Schrodinger equation. And the point I made is that when you connect it to contacts, you end up with, I guess I'll write it here, I h bar d psi dt equals h psi. But then to that, you add the sigma psi and the source term. And so this is the isolated system. If this is all you had, then the probability inside would always be conserved. If you looked at the total number of electrons, the psi star psi, if you add it all up, you'd find that doesn't change with time. That you can show. As long as H is Hermitian, that's guaranteed. Yeah. Okay. But this term, this sigma is not Hermitian. So once you bring that in, you'd find electrons are actually going out at some rate. And the source term is then what puts it back. And so there's this outflow and inflow, and that's what then, this difference between outflow and inflow from a given terminal, that's what gives you the current. So those were the equations that we went through. And there's this, that's this basic non-equilibrium green function method. And one point I want to mention here is that when you connect this to sigma 1 and sigma 2, that's these two contacts. And if you want to treat phase-breaking processes, that is also a little bit like, involves the same ideas, namely, usually, if you have some random potential in your device, you might say, well, I should just add it to H. I can add a H plus U if you had some random potential in your device. But this randomness, if you can account for by treating this U times psi, again, as a source term, as if it's a contact. Because then what would happen is this would give you a sigma S, which leads to electrons going out and coming back in again. And that was this last point that you had mentioned, that you have sigma 1, sigma 2 due to the two contacts, but then you have a sigma S due to these phase-breaking processes. And we took a particularly simple case where U is just a random number that is independent of X. And so then what happens is you get something like sigma S is equal to a number times G. And the only way it is different from the regular contacts is that for regular contacts, the sigma is fixed. Whereas here, the sigma depends on the Green's function itself. This G is not conductance, but it's a Green's function, as you realize. And so you end up with an iterative set of equations, which looks like EI minus H minus sigma 1 minus sigma 2. And then this one depends on G again. So it makes the solution a little more complicated because the expression for G again involves G. But once you include that, you have this phase breaking in the description. But this is the basic philosophy of, again, how you think of phase breaking processes. That is kind of like a contact where it takes out electrons and puts it back again. You see? And here we just describe the simplest case, simplest kind of scattering, where this is just a number. So this is just a number. And the only new thing that later on in this course we'll be introducing is that for different types of scattering, this D could take on more complicated forms. So for example, if you want to do inelastic scattering, then the D could be energy dependent or frequency dependent. And those are things we'll talk about later. Whereas at this time, we're just taking something that's just a number, which is just the RMS value of this random potential, some electron volt square, whatever that. But otherwise, the equations that you have now, in a way, are the full NEGF equations. So if you're just trying to calculate it, you just have these equations. And as I say, with these Green's function equations, the strength of it, the nice thing about it is that you can, it's perfectly general, so you could use it without really understanding much. And that is, of course, also the weakness, in the sense that you can calculate a lot without really knowing what it is you're calculating. You see? So in a way, what I'd really like to focus on more on the rest of the course is about understanding what we're calculating. Right? But as far as the mechanics for calculating it is concerned, you have it. I mean, this is it, really. There's not much I'll add, apart from, as I said, we might generalize the structure of the D a little bit when we talk about inelastic processes. That's it. Otherwise, equation-wise, this is it, really. But as I said, yeah, calculating and understanding are kind of two different things. Okay. Now, in terms of how you apply it then, a very good example is this last homework problem, where what I asked you to do was that consider a two-dimensional conductor with a certain width and find its conductance. So if we apply a small voltage across this, mu1, mu2, what current will flow? And what you have is a conductor described by some parabolic band with an effective mass. And so first step is write a H. How do you write a H? Well, we take a discrete lattice like so. Where you could say the diagonal element is, let's say, epsilon. The coupling to the nearest neighbor is, say, minus t. Now, we had done this once before with 1D. Now, it's like a 2D version of that. So, the 1D would have been like this, epsilon minus t. And the 2D version looks like this. Now, here, as we discussed, the EK relation looks like E equals epsilon minus 2t cosine kA. And if you want to fit it to a parabola, then what you do is expand the cosine as 1 minus k square a square over 2. So what you get then is epsilon minus 2t plus t a square times k square. So if you want to fit this to, say, h bar square k square over 2m, you know how to do this. That is, make this 0 and make that equal to h bar square over 2m. That's it. So this would be the 1D version. Now, if you want to do this in 2D, again, same story. It's like, now what you get is E is equal to epsilon minus 2t cosine kxa minus 2t cosine kya. this is what you'd end up with. And here again, if you use the parabolic approximation, you'll end up with something like this. Epsilon minus 4t minus ta square over ta square times kx square plus ky square. That's it. So again, you can adjust to see what you should use. Okay? So once you have set this up then, that's the H. Next is, how do I write the sigmas? So this is where we discussed one method last day, that the sigma in general is given by this tau. Let me take this off, because we probably don't need this. So your sigma is equal to tau G tau dagger, where the G is what you call the surface Green's function. So if you draw a line at some point, the surface Green's function means if I take EI minus H of this contact and invert it, what do I get at the surface, like we discussed, right? So what it involves is sort of inverting this tri-diagonal matrix, as we discussed. EI minus alpha down the diagonals with minus beta dagger on the upper diagonals, where alpha and beta, as I discussed, you can think of this column as alpha and the coupling as beta. Right? That was the discussion. And so what you're trying to do is invert this matrix, this tri-diagonal matrix, but you don't really want this full matrix. After you're all done, you just want the top, this top part right here, this top block. And this is where there is this simple iterative equation that one can use that I explained last day, that you can start with a guess, go to the next one till it converges. And that's the iterative method that people use for calculating the G. So let me stop here today and finish.